Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's all this talk out there about a double-dip recession, but you know who's not double-dipping at all? Companies, corporations, they're doing just great. Actual people, on the other hand, not really so much. Parallel Economies on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents Marketplace Minute, supported by Yellow Book 360. Tune in every Friday for Bill Radke's poetic take on the week's news in 60 seconds, available at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's great to have you with us on this Monday. It is the 2nd of August today, and I might have mentioned this before, but for a while during the depths of the financial crisis, we had a cliche wall set up in our offices, phrases that we tried real hard not to use. Right up at the top was "From Wall Street to Main Street," thanks to the rampant overuse of that phrase and all the stories about the disconnect between banking and the real economy. 2 years later on, the disconnect is still there. Over the weekend, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan took note of how uneven or even one-sided the recovery has been. In fact, Greenspan says there are, quote, fundamentally two separate economies right now. Banks, big companies, and Americans at the top of the income curve are doing just fine. But for the rest, Greenspan said the recovery seems to be on pause right now. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
It's about as plain spoken as the former Fed boss has ever been.
Our problem, basically, is that we have a very distorted economy.
Alan Greenspan told NBC's Meet the Press it's high-income Americans who are doing most of the spending these days. Big banks are, as he put it, doing much better, and large corporations are in excellent shape.
The rest of the economy, small business, small banks, and a very significant amount of the labor force, which is in tragic unemployment, long-term unemployment, that is pulling the economy apart. The average of those two is what we are looking at.
And all those federal spending programs that were supposed to fix things, University of Maryland economist Peter Morici says they haven't done much.
Most of the rescue money went to the large New York banks. It recapitalized them, while the smaller banks remain burdened by toxic assets. And they're the folks that make loans to small and medium-sized businesses. They can't get credit, so they can't expand and put people to work.
Morici says the big banks have been willing to lend, mostly to companies doing business abroad.
With demand growing very rapidly in Asia thanks to their undervalued currencies, they expand there and make big profits.
But wages here at home have been stagnant for decades, as far back as the 1970s. Diane Swank is chief economist at Mesirow Financial. She says that's about the time policymakers lost the focus on retraining American workers in favor of a less costly shortcut, just let everybody borrow more.
We found it more politically expedient to use a very advanced financial system to fill the gap in wages by giving people access to credit, perhaps when they couldn't even service the debt.
Swank says it's all come home to roost in this split recovery.
We've seen enormous political backlash, and there is no comfort for anyone who's wealthy if they've got to deal with a pretty big class warfare at the political level via taxes or anything else.
She says it's yet another after effect of the meltdown that's likely to linger for a long time. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
President Obama made a speech in Atlanta today. He told a disabled veterans group that the end is in sight in Iraq. The president said all combat troops are going to be out of the country by the end of this month. Beyond the 4,400 American lives lost, we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer what the total financial tab might wind up being.
So far, Congress has appropriated more than $700 billion for the war in Iraq. Some of that money went toward troop salaries and the cost of training Iraqi security forces. Gordon Adams is an analyst at the Stimson Center, a defense think tank. He says there's also the cost of supporting the troops.
All of the expenditure for fuel and transportation and ammunition and running the dining halls and contracting.
There will still be about 50,000 non-combat troops in Iraq through the end of next year. When they're gone, only the State Department will be left. Todd Harrison is with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He says while the military used contractors for cooking and laundry, the State Department will need workers with more skill who demand high salaries.
Security contractors, translators, people like that.
But even after the State Department takes over and U.S. forces are gone, the military will still be absorbing costs of the Iraq War. Many U.S. troops have been permanently disabled. And today, President Obama said the government will spare no expense taking care of them.
This is the sacred trust we have pledged to uphold. To you and all who serve.
So far, 38% of the veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have filed claims for government disability payments. That's according to Harvard professor Linda Bilmes. She says the government will spend even more on these veterans as they age.
So very significant disability compensation payouts over many, many decades that will be peaking, you know, 30 or 40 years from now.
Bilmes estimates that over the decades, those disability costs will add up to $500 billion. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Crude oil topped $81 a barrel today for the first time since May. Overall economic optimism is what the analysts are saying. Other commodities have been more hit or miss. Producers of the other white meat have had it hard. First, there was that virus that was called swine flu. Not so good. Then sky-high prices for corn and soybeans, the things that pigs eat. But this is the season of the BLT bump. Pork prices trend higher in the summertime, especially this summer. Cash pork rose to a three-month high last week. Hog futures on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange pulled higher today in response, as Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
If your bacon costs more than it used to, you can blame it in part on a summer sandwich staple.
Many consumers like a little bit lighter fare, like a BLT sandwich, and that does help the demand and help support prices in the summertime.
That's Purdue University Ag Professor Chris Hurt. He says this summer's bacon price bump is even higher than usual. Farmers culled their swine herds after a disastrous few years when hog feed and corn prices skyrocketed. The reduced supply eventually caught up and raised prices at the supermarket. Bacon's now about 12 cents higher on average than it was last year. And commodities are connected. The extreme heat and drought in Russia right now sent grain futures on a tear today. Wheat was up more than 40 cents a bushel. Professor Hurt says that'll affect global meat prices for months to come.
We're going to continue to see those high retail prices, grocery store and restaurants for beef as well as pork, continuing on through 2010 and most of 2011.
Many economists think of meat as interchangeable. If pork chops become too expensive, well, we'll just eat the sirloin or roast chicken. But in lots of trendy cafes, bacon has become ubiquitous. North Carolina chef Chris Stinnett owns French bistro Rue Claire in Durham.
We cure the bellies. We make our own bacon with the bellies. We confit them. We braise them.
Chef Stinnett will cut back on the bread, but give up bacon? Maybe when pigs fly. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
I do love a good BLT. I don't know what they were eating on Wall Street today, but it went down pretty well. We will have the details when we do the numbers. State education officials around the country are having a busy day. Today is a key deadline in the Obama administration's race to the top. That's the $4 billion pot of federal money that states can get if they agree to certain policy changes. One of those changes, and this is today's deadline, is to sign on to a national set of common curriculum standards that could bring the education marketplace from widely fractured and segmented with dozens of different standards into something resembling coherence. Christopher Swanson is the Vice President for Research and Development at Education Week. Mr. Swanson, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
It's a mistake to talk about a national education market, I suppose, but this drive to get some uniform core curriculum standards does kind of change the market dynamic for things like testing and textbooks, doesn't it?
Well, that's very much the idea, and I think you're right. You know, historically, education in general has been a very localized pursuit. If this common education, this common standards and assessment movement goes where some people are hoping it will, then we may really start to look at something that looks much more like a national education market.
And then those purchasers in that market would have the purchasing power. They would be able to say, listen, we've got 46 states or whatever it is. We need cheaper and better.
Well, that's one thing. And certainly part of the explicit discussion about why we would want common standards or common assessments is we can pool our resources, we can develop better tests, we can develop better expectations, And that will drive the market in a very different way. If you're a test publisher, it really changes your mindset and thinking about, well, I can kind of market to this state and this state and this state, and they're all a little bit different. But if there is much more wide adoption of common expectations for curriculum materials or assessments, then it is a really, really different kind of game.
So if I'm the head of educational testing services in Princeton, New Jersey today, watching these votes come in as people raise their core curriculum standards, am I getting a little bit nervous?
Well, you know, you would certainly want to have your plan in order. But whether, you know, if you're an established player with a lot of research and development resource and established relationships with states and you know, other players out there, even if the game really changes, you're well positioned to, you know, act quickly. On the other hand, you wonder if there could be some wild cards here. You go from 50-plus markets to one market, and if you've got somebody out there who can work really creatively and quickly and put together a good product, then maybe, you know, it's a world in which that kind of fresh, innovative competitor can stand up against some of these more established players.
About the federal money that is, in theory, driving the most recent set of events and pushing people toward core standards, is it possible that the hundreds of millions of dollars that some states are going to eventually get because of Race to the Top might actually be dwarfed by the amount of money that they could conceivably save by the changing dynamics of the market?
Well, that's entirely possible, but it's a very highly leveraged investment and attention by the federal government. So a couple $100 million here and there sounds like a lot of money, but when you look at kind of the, you know, textbook and instructional materials market, that's a $8 billion industry per year. And when you think of, you know, how much potential cost savings there is, I think nobody's quite sure about what that would look like exactly.
What happens once all this federal money gets leveraged out through the education system and the market dynamics change? I mean, then what happens? Now what do we do?
I think it depends on, you know, how deeply embedded these changes get in the state education systems in particular. There's always a little bit of a wait and see here, and I think this is no exception. But at least now, I think there's some real potential for change in a way that we haven't seen in a very long time within education. And just the fact that we're having kind of a public and open, spirited, but positive discussion about the possibility of national standards, that's a very different education world than it has been in the past. And so, yeah, I wouldn't rule anything out necessarily.
Christopher Swanson, he's the Vice President for Research and Development at Education Week. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tom. My pleasure.
Business travel can be a fairly daunting proposition. Crammed as you are in the middle seat on a cross-country flight, only to be greeted by yet another anonymous hotel room wherever you get where you're going. It's enough to take the competitive drive out of anybody. For our series Road Warriors, producer Micah Rayfield is introducing us to the soundtracks that people use when they're away on business. Today, a woman who needs her music to get motivated to meet with clients.
I'm Alexander Franzen. I'm a creative resume designer and copywriter in Minneapolis, St. Paul. The soundtrack to my time on the road is Right Hand High by Kid Sister. Right Hand High is basically just a party jam. It's got like a very strong 4-4 beat. It's hard to listen to it without getting really, really energized. The lyrics are very empowering, especially for women. Kid Sister has a very sort of tongue-in-cheek attitude towards working and making money and being successful. She's very unabashed about the fact that she wants to make a lot of money. In the song, she says, "I'm stacking money all night." But at the same time, she is very sort of coy and funny about it. She realizes that success is very fleeting and that really it's just about the journey and kind of keeping high energy and staying positive. So for me, I love listening to it before any kind of work situation because it kind of gets me in this like hustling frame of mind.
And I do it in some heels. Over and over, I'm rocking, pulling to the clip with the sunroof popping. Got a little land going around the block. It ain't no stopping, not 'cause
I work a lot with really creative people who maybe have never had a traditional resume before, or who have a resume but just have never really had to use it because they're a musician, they're an artist, they're a comedian, but for whatever reason, they want to take another look at their personal brand. Maybe they're applying for their first quote-unquote real job. And I help them sort of piece together their eclectic work history in a way that feels really authentic and not corporate and creepy, and put together a resume that really rocks for them.
In response to popular demand, we've got a new music section on our website. You can check out some of Alexandra's other favorites there. And while you're at it, offer us up your own playlist. It's on our homepage, marketplace.org. Coming up on the internet.
The combination of a perfectly normal human being, total anonymity, and an audience will result in a cesspit.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rocketed 208 points higher today, almost 2%, notched at 10,674. NASDAQ picked up 40 points, around 2%, ended at 2295. The S&P 500 tacked on 24 points. That is more than 2%, closed at 1125. The Institute of Supply Management said today that manufacturing activity grew for the 12th straight month in July. High-tech manufacturing looked like the busiest cog in that machine. Computer chip maker Intel booted up more than 2.3% today. Texas Instruments tallied up more than 1.5%. Financial stocks did some addition of their own. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank gains of 3.3%. Bank of America lofted more than 2.75% higher. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.96%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on personal income and spending for June. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index for June. And the Senate Budget Committee examines a status report on the U.S. economy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a market research firm out there called Nielsen. Not Nielsen, the television ratings people. It's Nielsen. They cover the payment industry, how people pay for what they buy. A statistic from them that I read the other day says that between them, Visa and MasterCard handled 82% of credit card-based consumer spending every year, which means if you can make a dent in that number, take away some of that action, there is a ton of money to be made. And it may well be made with cell phone companies doing it. Marketplace's Steve Henn is here to explain. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right. So this new system, how might it work?
Well, it'd probably be pretty simple. You know, you could just wave your cell phone next to a reader in the checkout line that's hooked up to your credit card, and voila, you've paid. You know, systems like this have been around for years, I think 6 years in Japan and for a while in Europe. So the problem hasn't been a technological one here in the United States. The problem's been getting a bunch of different companies to cooperate. You had to get credit card companies online, different cell phone providers online, and then the retailers to agree to this too, and then possibly deploy some new equipment, lots of new equipment in their stores around the country. So the big news today is that the three biggest cell phone companies, AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile, have reportedly agreed to work together with Discover Card and put something in place.
What about the retailers, though, right? You need that other leg of the three-legged stool.
Yeah, and that's important. And retailers will have to spend potentially billions of dollars to put new readers in stores all across the country. But Brian Dodge at the Retail Industry Leaders Association says, you know, store owners are pretty tired of paying huge fees to credit card companies, specifically MasterCard and Visa, for processing their transactions.
Last year, retailers paid in excess of $48 billion in what are called interchange fees. And these are the fees that are paid every time that a consumer swipes his or her card in their stores.
The other thing that's interesting is AT&T and Verizon also pay these fees whenever their customers pay their cell phone bills with their credit cards. So, you know, that's one more reason for them to jump in on this market and introduce competition. And the cell phone companies could also make some money where credit card companies can't. You know, if you think about it, your cell phone's always in your pocket. If they know that you have, you know, a weakness for tech gadgets and they know you're walking by the Apple store, they could send you a discount or a message or an ad for that iPad that you've been thinking about.
But I don't want to be marketed to like that. I mean, that's the thing that people are going to say, right? I just want to use this as a convenience without giving up any of my privacy.
Yeah, no, it's kind of creepy. But marketers are desperate to slip into your pocket with your cell phone. And, you know, I think they're going to try everything conceivably possible to get in there.
One last thing about privacy and cell phones. This news out of the UAE about BlackBerry being shut off over in the United Arab Emirates and maybe in Saudi Arabia, too. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I think it's another example of how powerful cell phones are, especially smartphones. They control and collect your location, your conversations, your emails, your texts, and potentially, you know, a lot of information about your spending habits soon, too. And just like marketers, governments are going to want to get at that and pay attention to it, especially if they're worried about terrorism or controlling the information that their population gets to see and consume.
Steve Henn, up in Silicon Valley for us. Thanks, Steve.
Sure thing.
Time was when all that websites wanted was traffic, eyeballs, and attention. One way to do that, one way to get some buzz going and make readers feel involved, was having a comments section. News stories, sports teams, even big consumer brands invited people to chime in and speak up. That helped build vibrant online communities that are sometimes liabilities. The muck that flies around in your typical online comment stream can devalue a brand, it can scare off advertisers, and eventually your readers. With so many companies soliciting your comments, the work of policing those comments then has itself become big business, as Marketplace's Jeff Horowitz reports.
In internet culture, the tendency of online comments to head for the gutter has a name, the Greater Internet Jerkwad Theory. Okay, it's not really a jerkwad, but what do you think this is, the internet? Eva Galperin with the Electronic Frontier Foundation defines it.
The theory posits that the combination of a perfectly normal human being, total anonymity, and an audience will result in a cesspit.
Online comments are a magnet for name-calling, political screeds, nastiness that turns off web surfers like Meg Fielding of Baltimore.
The level of bile and just rage and hate, I'm sometimes almost have to like push myself back from the desk because I'm so appalled and so horrified at what people will say.
For news-related sites especially, the free expression free-for-all is wearing thin, and the cost of all that online vitriol is mounting. So they're calling in the comment cops. At a company called Pluck in Austin, Texas, 20 moderators for hire keep the peace for sites like USA Today and the Green Bay Press-Gazette, as well as non-news clients like Kraft Foods or AARP. Pluck's founder, Steve Semmelsberger, says professional comment moderation has become a business necessity.
When you have a core article that has a number of advertisements running against it, it's important that it's not something that major advertisers are uncomfortable with.
Pluck moderators review thousands of so-called user abuse events every day, applying a heavier or a lighter hand depending on the customer. The NFL, for example, might be fine with comments that wouldn't fly on NPR. With 3.2 million comments in June, the Huffington Post didn't hire a company to moderate. It bought one. This summer, the politics and news site acquired Adaptive Semantics and its proprietary software called Julia. Ariana Huffington is the site's editor-in-chief.
You can program Julia to look for whatever you don't want on your site. For example, we don't like people comparing either Democrats or Republicans to Nazis.
But Julia is way smarter than that. Its algorithms look for patterns that indicate anyone disruptive, veering off topic, ranting like a zealot, using insulting language. Even mild terms like moron or empty suit can flag you for a look from a human moderator who gets final say over whether to ban your comment. Huffington is also trying to take on the bad seeds by deputizing the best commenters with digital badges like a level 2 networker or level 3 super user.
They actually become incredibly useful in helping us moderate the site. It's like their site.
The HuffPost requires commenters to register, and it encourages them to use their real names. That makes things more civil. It also creates a data trail of individual passions and preferences. Huffington says that data might be useful down the road.
Making sure that they get more of the content that particularly interests them and then selling advertising around that content.
Facebook is also helping pull the curtain back on anonymous web commenters. An increasing number of sites, including HuffPost, allow users to log in using their Facebook ID. It's convenient. Sure, that's the appeal. But it also links commenters to their real names and photos. And Facebook has changed the online culture. Steve Semmelsberger of Pluck says Facebook's MO, no pseudonyms, has made millions of people more open with their opinions.
There is an increased sense of accountability to come right in and present yourself as your true self versus a screen display name.
As technology makes it easier to enforce accountability and civility online, that may be good for business. But Eva Galperin of the Electronic Frontier Foundation says anonymity still has an important place in online life.
People can voice unpopular opinions. They can maintain a certain level of privacy and safety and distance. This goes all the way back to the founding fathers who printed their pamphlets under pseudonyms.
Who knows? Perhaps the next revolution will begin with a trenchant post on marketplace.org, if our comment managers don't catch it first. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, courtesy of the Miami Herald. The Herald is now the hometown newspaper of one LeBron James, who not too long ago held the sporting world hostage to his announcement of where he's going to play basketball for the next couple of years. As you might figure, season ticket sales for the Miami Heat went crazy after James signed. So crazy, in fact, that the team has laid off its entire season ticket sales staff. The team says it doesn't have any season tickets left to sell, so it doesn't need a staff anymore. Ouch, right? That is Marketplace on this Monday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shot up 208 points, almost 2%, ended at 10,674. The NASDAQ picked up 40 points, about 2%, ended at 2295. The S&P 500 gained 24 points. That is more than 2%, closed at 1125. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this radio broadcast, Dirty Oil on the Cheap.
If you could go to these places, I suspect, gasoline would be 50 cents a liter and oil would be 20 bucks a barrel.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.